Happy New Year, everyone. We're a day late, but not a dollar short, because, of course, we're bringing a great episode of All Movie Talk with us. We will begin by talking about the 1990s, continuing our Best Of series. The 1990s was a great decade. Of course, we'll have a trivia question, as always, and continue our talk about the Academy Awards, and we'll remind you about the game that you can play on the RinkWorks website and win potentially a prize if you are good at predicting the nominees. And then we'll have another entry in our Film Buffs Dictionary talking about what a tracking shot means and how it was developed and a lot of famous tracking shots. And that continues on into our top six list, which is about the top six traveling shots. It's a little more general than a tracking shot, but we'll get to explaining what that is later. Wrapping up the episode, a good bad movie segment about the movie Night of the Lepus, a movie about giant bunny rabbits. So, great episode. Stay tuned for it. I am Sam Stoddard.
And I'm Stephen Keller. And hey, Sam, I heard you have an extra dollar. You're not a buck short? Because I am. Could I go ahead and just borrow a dollar? I'll pay it back next Tuesday.
We're up to part 7 of our Best Of series, where we go year by year through film history, naming some of the great movies and talking about the Academy Award-winning Best Picture, as well as my personal favorite from each year. This week, we'll be talking about the 1990s. Now, in this time, much of what happened with film owes something to one of two titles. In 1989, Steven Soderbergh's Sex, Lies, and Videotape exposed a bigger market for independent film than anybody really thought was there. That really opened up the doors for people like Quentin Tarantino to experiment with small budgets. One by one, the studios all opened up indie divisions, resulting in the strange situation where you have independent films financed by studios, if that makes any sense at all. Number two is Steven Spielberg's Jurassic Park, which gave the blockbuster business a huge boost. It introduced moviegoers to the potential of computer-generated imagery to create realistic monsters on the screen. To see a CGI beastie in a movie now is old hat already, but I can remember 1993 being just absolutely astonished at how real those dinosaurs were. I was also scared out of my mind, but this reinvigorated the special effects movie and really heated up the race to make each new movie more dazzling than the one before.
Yeah, I remember thinking when Jurassic Park came out that there was no possible way special effects could ever get any better than that. That was going to be the pinnacle.
But of course they did. But let's backtrack a little bit to 1990 and talk about that year. The Best Picture went to Dances with Wolves, which was highly acclaimed at the time and very popular. Personally, I thought it was too long, too boring, and just too pretentious. Other better choices for the best movie of this year would be Goodfellas, Miller's Crossing, La Femme Nikita, The Hunt for Red October, and Misery. I think of all those, Goodfellas is a pretty easy pick. It's a little harsh for me to enjoy in the traditional sense, but I admired the way it makes what we understand of humanity seem natural in such an unfamiliar lifestyle as the mob. And it illustrates how great rewards can turn to fear and isolation at the drop of a hat when violence is a part of business, and how this kind of atmosphere can just drive you mad with paranoia.
And I think it's Goodfellas, actually, more than The Godfather, which has really set up the sort of modern perception of the mafia. Certainly, like, Sopranos and that kind of stuff seems a lot more like the crass crudeness of Goodfellas than it does the sort of elegance of The Godfather. But I'll pick Goodfellas, too. It's not too harsh for me to enjoy. I love it. And that's, as we've mentioned before, because I'm sick and dead inside. But I think Goodfellas is a real fun movie. Scorsese's at the top of his game in terms of the way he makes this flick. And so, 1991, what do we have?
Well, for the first and probably last time, an animated feature was nominated for Best Picture. It was Beauty and the Beast, and of the nominees, I think it should have won. What did win was also worthy, however, it was The Silence of the Lambs. Other highly regarded movies of 1991, The Fisher King, JFK, Terminator 2, Boys in the Hood, Raise the Red Lantern, and The Double Life of Veronique. I am incredibly torn here because, besides Beauty and the Beast, two of my favorite movies of the decade were made here, and they are Barton Fink by the Coen brothers and Dead Again, the best thriller Hitchcock never made, and more. Barton Fink is probably the better movie. Dead Again is probably the one I'd prefer to rewatch, so, you know, do I have to break this tie? Maybe my choice is Fink again.
I actually think the Academy got it right. Silence of the Lambs is such a great thriller and so effective.
It is great, yeah.
I pretty much love it on every level. Though I just want to give a special nod to Terminator 2, which may be the best action movie we'll ever see. I'm not sure. I think Aliens might be better. I go back and forth. Anyway, 1992.
The best picture was Unforgiven. It was only the third Western the Academy chose to honor with its highest award, and guess what? Finally, they picked an actually good Western. Other great movies of 1992, The Player, Of Mice and Men, Porco Rosso, Aladdin, Glengarry Glen Ross, and Howard's End. Many would also list Reservoir Dogs, but I guess I'm in the minority on that one. My favorite movie from 1992 is an adaptation of a stage play called Noises Off. It would rank high on my list of the funniest movies ever made. It stars Michael Caine as the frazzled director of a doomed play, and has a lot of other great actors in this: Carol Burnett, Christopher Reeve, Denholm Elliott, and so on. The film essentially runs through this first act of this fictional play three times, once in rehearsal and twice in front of live audiences, and as all the complex interrelationships between the characters degrades, the production becomes more and more chaotic. Every time I see this, I just laugh about nonstop, and it's just so fast-paced and perfectly timed. A lot of really rapid banter back and forth, and lots of physical stuff. The stage blocking must have been a nightmare to coordinate. But at any rate, fantastic cast, funny movie. You know, if it's not the most dazzling and insightful work of film, it's certainly a great entertainment.
I think my pick is probably The Player, one of my favorite comedies, and I think I've talked about it before on this show in our Movies About Movies top six list, but I think one of the best comedies from the 90s that also has a whole lot to say about the process of making movies. And, of course, Robert Altman directs it absolutely pitch perfect the whole way through. Funny and sharp without ever being light or breezy. It's the sort of dark comedy that I really, really enjoy.
That's definitely a favorite of mine. For 1993, the best picture went to Schindler's List, and I cannot agree more. I think this is probably the best film of the 1990s for me. There's real power in scene after scene after scene. There's this great, powerful, heartbreaking shot of Ben Kingsley walking away and trying to maintain his poise as Jews are being shot around him by a Nazi who's basically just picking them off for kicks. This is a really resonating scene for me, among many others, such as a scene where Schindler uses coldly practical reasoning to persuade a guard to let him keep the Jewish children with him. Of course, there's a brilliant thread about the girl in the red dress that we've talked about before when we talked about color, but anyway, just one moment after another that really resonates. So it's no contest for me. However, another of my favorite films of the 1990s, Shortcuts, was also released in 1993. It would be an easy winner for me in almost any other year. And other choices include The Fugitive, The Remains of the Day, Groundhog Day, Blue, the first of the Three Colors trilogy by Krzysztof Kieślowski, also Farewell, My Concubine, and in deference to its groundbreaking effect, Jurassic Park.
I think Jurassic Park is a pretty great film. And, you know, I'm not one of those people who's really down on Schindler's List, but I don't think it's quite as good as you do. People pick on it a lot, and probably unfairly, but, you know, some of the stuff they do pick on, the scene, oh, this ring could have been whatever, this car could have been more lives, it does get a little too melodramatic, and you talk about...
I think that's the only point, though. That's one
well,
scene...
Also, trotting out all the actual, like, living people at the end, that's...
I don't know.
That's I don't know.
I mean, it's 2.5 hours of really brilliant stuff. You know, Psycho had a bad ending, and it's still a classic, so...
Yeah, that's true. I think part of people's complaints about it is that Spielberg takes a real tragedy and turns into a little too much of a melodrama at times. Other times it's perfect, but I don't know. Spielberg has some trouble with shades of gray sometimes. He likes to make movies about contrast, and you mentioned the Nazi guard just picking off Jews because he's a homicidal maniac. That kind of characterization, I don't know. I think it hurts the film a bit. But still, obviously, a great movie and very important. Okay, my favorite year from the 1990s is about to come up. 1994, I'm excited.
Well, the best picture went to Forrest Gump, which is probably not one of your choices, but this is a movie that was so popular, it's experiencing a bit of unfair backlash now. It really is a remarkable film, and not really quite like anything else, actually. But this was also the year of Pulp Fiction and The Shawshank Redemption and other great films, such as Quiz Show, The Professional, White and Red, the other two films in the Three Colors trilogy, also Ed Wood, Hoop Dreams, The Lion King, Once Were Warriors, and The Legend of Drunken Master. I should also mention that this is when the best of the Wallace and Gromit shorts, The Wrong Trousers, came out. But my pick, well, there's a lot of great choices there. I'm going to go with Pulp Fiction, though.
Yeah, me too. I'd also like to point out again the Three Colors trilogy, which, you know, came out across 2 years. It's really practically one movie if you watch it in the right way, even though it's three separate stories. Really worth checking out. Also from 1994, one of my favorite comedies of the decade, Clerks by Kevin Smith. When you talk about independent films, I think you absolutely have to mention Clerks. And it came out the same year as Pulp Fiction, and both of those movies sort of inspired a wave of very derivative, though not necessarily bad, independent films. But yeah, I mean, Pulp Fiction just towers above everything in the 1990s. I think it's definitely the most influential film in the 90s, and also great. But I mean, wow, Pulp Fiction, Shawshank, Hoop Dreams, oh wow, what a good year.
Yeah.
And I think probably the pinnacle of the 90s. 1995, not as good.
Well, the best picture was Braveheart, and that's a good choice. I also want to compliment the Academy on nominating Babe. I mean, it's a movie about a talking pig, not a typical Oscar bait. But you know what? It's absolutely enchanting and worthy of the nomination. Other choices here, Heat, Toy Story, 12 Monkeys, Il Postino, Sense and Sensibility, Apollo 13, The Usual Suspects, Casino, Before Sunrise, Get Shorty, and some would also say Seven, but not me. But what a lineup here. I think this may be the pinnacle is still continuing from the previous year. I only got this list down to 7 titles before I started having real trouble picking between them, and I think my final 3 wound up being Heat, Babe, and Toy Story, and there's really no sensible way to compare these, so I'm just going to say Toy Story and leave it at that.
I can get behind Toy Story as well. I could also get behind Heat and argue it, I think, for 12 Monkeys. And yeah, definitely another great year. The mid-90s were just real strong in general. What about 1996? I think I know what your pick might be here.
Well, this was a real banner year for independent and small studio films. I think the beginning of the wave that you said was created by Pulp Fiction and Clerks is starting to come to fruition here. Independent films made up 4 of the 5 Best Picture nominees, and the winner was The English Patient, a sweeping lyrical epic in the tradition of David Lean, if not as strong. But other nominees were Fargo, Secrets and Lies, Shine, and the only big studio film, Jerry Maguire. Other great movies, Trainspotting, Shall We Dance, that's a Japanese version, Hamlet by Kenneth Branagh, Lone Star, and Sling Blade,
Some fried bananas.
The best film is clearly Fargo, however, and I'll let Stephen briefly explain why.
Well, what about it isn't great? It's probably the best of the modern films noir. Great use of color with this bleak, desolate snowscape in the Midwest during the middle of winter. And just stunning performances from Frances McDormand, who won the Oscar that year, and deservedly so, even if the movie was robbed of its Best Picture win. I mean, The English Patient, does anyone actually think that's as good as Fargo today? I don't think so.
It's also really funny, we should say. It's a dark humor, not really punchlines, but pretty funny if you get onto its wavelength.
And, I mean, so iconic, everyone remembers the, oh, don't you know, performance that McDormand gives, and also really good performances from William H. Macy as the used car salesman whose scheme about kidnapping spirals way out of his control. He goes kind of nuts trying to keep it all together. And also really good supporting performances from people like Steve Buscemi, and just a fantastic movie, one of the best of the 90s.
Yeah. So that brings us to 1997, which was the year of Titanic, a real phenomenon in so many ways. It tied the record for the most nominations of the Academy at 14, and the number of wins at 11. It beat the record for the most weeks at number one at the box office. It was the first film to gross $600 million domestically when no film had even done $500 at that time. It was the first to surpass $1 billion worldwide and actually got pretty close to $2 billion. Obviously, with this much success, there would be a huge backlash, and that's still going on. Definitely people look back on Titanic and think it was the worst movie of all time. I think this is just ridiculous. This is an absolutely phenomenal film and a great accomplishment. I think there's a lot more to the characters than the generic stock lovers that they get remembered as. And I came away from this film emotionally wrenched in a way very few movies do to me. Now, other great movies made this year, Life is Beautiful, Princess Mononoke, Good Will Hunting, Open Your Eyes, As Good as It Gets, Donnie Brasco, Gattaca, Boogie Nights, The Game, and Jackie Brown. My pick is almost Titanic, but I have to go with L.A. Confidential, and I'll let Stephen briefly explain why.
Oh, here we are again, another great modern noir movie that kind of breaks tradition. It's not nearly as gritty and dark as other noir movies, though it certainly is fairly grisly at a couple points, but a great ensemble cast, including a bunch of people who are going to become a lot more famous after this movie. We have Kevin Spacey, Russell Crowe, Guy Pearce, a great role in Memento, and just a really good ensemble cast. Kim Basinger in a wonderful performance helped, I think, transition her from a ditzy hot blonde chick to more of a serious actress, and she still shows up today, though maybe she's not as prominent as she was in the mid-90s. And a really wonderful story, just expertly told, that navigates 1950s Los Angeles. It feels almost like a modern Chinatown in some ways, in the way that it really, I think, recaptures the underside of the City of Angels.
Yeah, and what's interesting is we remember this movie as kind of an intimate film, maybe. It is sprawling in a sense, sort of epic, but I don't think when we remember this we realize that there were, I forget the numbers exactly, but something like over 100 speaking roles or over 100 locations, something like that. I mean, both of these numbers are very high, and it might sound like it's difficult to follow, but it's really not, because it's just so focused in handling all these big, disparate elements that we remember it as being almost a small movie.
Yeah, and it does a good job of drawing distinct characters who aren't one-dimensional. So what about 1998? I know this is a year that you loved.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite recent years for movies. Some of my absolute favorites here: Pleasantville, The Truman Show, Dark City, and The Red Violin. Also, Elizabeth, Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, The Prince of Egypt, Run Lola Run, Following, and Primary Colors. But this is the infamous year where Shakespeare in Love beat Saving Private Ryan to the Best Picture Award. Now, Shakespeare in Love is a smart and quite clever comedy, well-written, sweet, and gorgeous to look at, but Saving Private Ryan is transcendent. The first 20 minutes chronicle the landing at Omaha Beach, and I think it's probably the best shot war scene ever. You really feel like one of the nameless soldiers in that attack, disoriented and not entirely sure what's going on. And when an explosion occurs too close, the sound fades out temporarily like your ears are ringing. It's just brilliantly done. And the movie slows down a bit and explores a lot of other different types of wartime situations later on in the movie, both emotional and moral. When you capture an enemy and you don't have the resources to hold him prisoner, for example, do you shoot him in cold blood or let him go so he can tell everybody you're there? And I love the scene toward the end where one soldier is just frozen in fear and cannot act, even though a fellow soldier just up the stairs a little ways needs his help. It's agonizing. It made me angry, but you know what? It's a very truthful, very moving portrait of this kind of mentality in wartime. And there's also this great shot of a German soldier just walking by this character because he just knows this guy is not a threat. He doesn't even need to kill him. You know, there's just scene after scene in this movie that's either brilliant or original or thought-provoking or emotionally evocative or all of the above. Obviously, this is my pick for 1998.
It is interesting. Maybe it runs a little too long, and I don't like the bookends like, you know, everyone else. I don't think anyone but maybe you likes the bookends. But it's hard to, I think, overstate how important this movie is in terms of the way modern war movies look. Spielberg really set the tone in terms of using different film speeds and combat and handheld camera for a lot of stuff and different film stocks. Also should mention, just as an interesting companion, the other World War II film from 1998, which is about as different in every way as you could imagine, and that's Terrence Malick's The Thin Red Line. Certainly a very interesting, completely different take on the same kind of material.
That's great that you like that one. I did not like The Thin Red Line at all. I think it was a little too full of itself, but definitely I can see a certain perspective there.
Okay, so we come to one of my also favorite years, along with 94, 1999.
The best picture in 99 went to American Beauty, which was a great film. Other choices, Topsy-Turvy, which is a particular favorite of mine and just so well written. It's about Gilbert and Sullivan and a crucial point in their career when they decide to write The Mikado, but very well written and acted with a lot of scenes that show kind of the big picture of what it's like producing theater. Also, The Matrix came out this year, The Green Mile, Magnolia, The Insider, The Straight Story, Being John Malkovich, Fight Club, and Three Kings. I could certainly spend some time talking about all of those. In the animated category, Tarzan, The Iron Giant, and Toy Story 2, which I thought was even better than the original. But my pick this year is M. Night Shyamalan's The Sixth Sense, which is not just a great ride as a horror thriller, and it does not just have one of the greatest twist endings in recent memory, but it's actually a profoundly moving character story. In fact, almost all of the movie's best scenes, for me, are not about ghosts ghosts or scares at all, but dramatic moments between the characters, like the one where Haley Joel Osment meets Bruce Willis for the first time and Osment takes a step forward or back depending on how well Willis can guess the answers to his own questions. My favorite scene, which has me riveted to the screen every time, is right at the end. It's a simple conversation between mother and son that takes place in a car. There are no fancy camera tricks, not one note on the soundtrack. It's just dialogue and acting in a key emotional moment in the relationship between two characters we've come to care about.
So in the year that gives us Fight Club, Magnolia, Being John Malkovich, Three Kings, Toy Story 2, American Beauty, you pick a ghost movie?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, I mean, I like Sixth Sense, but wow. I mean, I don't think Sixth Sense would make my top five, but my pick is Being John Malkovich, which I know you and I have gone back and forth on, but I think it's a wonderfully bizarre comedy and a great debut from Spike Jonze. Just a whole lot of fun. One thing I think is interesting about 1999 is how so many of the very memorable movies are sort of about similar things, about materialism and consumerism and where we're at in society. You look at American Beauty and Fight Club, even to a lesser extent something like Magnolia or Three Kings or Being John Malkovich are all sort of about the idea of people being a little disconnected from society and trying to find their role, trying to figure out what really matters to them. And I think that's interesting because there aren't necessarily a lot of years with that similar kind of focus to them.
Yeah, that's a good point. Being John Malkovich, you mentioned we go back and forth on it, and just to spell that out for our listeners, we both like it, it's just that Stephen likes it a whole lot more than I do. I didn't think it was emotional enough. It's sort of a detached kind of feeling to it, and, you know, that is to an extent the point, but if I am a viewer am detached, I think that's a problem, but definitely it's very clever. So next week will be the last installment in this Best Of series that has been running for almost 2 months now, but we're going to talk about the best movies of the 2000s. So check back with us then. Steven, do you know what the Hollywood Walk of Fame is?
Yeah, I've been there.
Okay, well, that wasn't the trivia question.
Damn it!
It consists of thousands of stars set into the pavement along certain streets in Hollywood. Each star has a name and an icon on it, and the icon indicates what that person's being honored for. Now, there are five different icons. The movie camera for recognizing contributions to film, a TV set for recognizing contributions to television, a microphone for radio, a record for the recording industry, and the comedy tragedy mask for contributions to live theater. Now, it doesn't happen so much anymore, but the same person can be awarded multiple stars for recognizing contributions to multiple industries, but only one person has ever been awarded all five stars, one for each of the five industries. Do you know who that is, Steven?
No idea. What a surprise.
Okay, we'll take a wild guess. And if you get it right, we'll have to cut it out because this is the beginning of the show, but take a wild guess.
George Burns?
Okay, we will see if he is correct or not toward the end of the show.
Well, just as a reminder, the Academy Awards nominations game over at the Rinkworks website is still going on. There are 3 weeks left before nominations, so if you'd like to compete in the game and see if you can predict the most Oscar nominations and win our exciting prize for the winner, head over to rinkworks.com, rinkworks.com, register for the Academy Awards predictions game, and enter your guesses. You do need to enter a special code to be eligible for the prize, however, and the only place you can get that code is right here on the All Movie Talk podcast, specifically episode 11. If you missed that one, go to our website, allmovietalk.com, and you can find episode 11 there. Listen to it, and we'll give you the prize code. Steven, what's our prize again?
It is a copy of Making Movies, the great book by the great director Sidney Lumet, and it's an entertaining and interesting look at all sorts of different aspects of how movies are made and some of the great stories that Lumet has to tell about the movies he has made.
Yeah, that's a fantastic book. But let's talk a bit about what in the Oscar race has changed since the last time we talked about it 3 weeks ago. Actually, not a whole lot has changed. Usually, we see the buzz around certain movies or performances fluctuate as the season progresses, and I expect that will actually still happen. But as of now, things seem more or less like they were back in episode 11 when we started talking about this. One thing that has changed, however, is the emergence of the first precursor awards. There are a whole bunch of awards that get handed out before the Oscars do, like the Golden Globes. You're probably familiar with that one, but there's a whole bunch of them. Some of these are good indicators of what we'll see the Oscars doing later on. One that isn't a good predictor, despite a lot of entertainment media trying to convince you otherwise, is the Golden Globes. A lot of people hype that one as a real Oscar predictor, but I don't know. I don't think the stats hold up.
Yeah, well, part of it is, I think, Hollywood Foreign Press Association. The people who actually vote on the Golden Globes, that's a weird, mysterious group of people. The membership list is secret, I think. And, yeah, they're not the same as the actual Oscar voters. They're not the same as the Academy, which is a much wider, larger group. So their tastes aren't always necessarily aligned. I do think there is some overlap. Part of it is the Golden Globes get to nominate 10 best pictures because they break up the awards between drama and musical or comedy. So, you know, if you throw up enough, you're bound to hit some. But definitely, just because you win a Golden Globe doesn't mean you're going to win an Oscar. In fact, you know, famously, Jim Carrey won 2 Golden Globes in a row, two years in a row, and wasn't nominated for an Oscar for either of those performances for The Truman Show and Man in the Moon.
Yeah. The reality is, when the Golden Globe nominations were announced, it didn't tell us anything new that we didn't already know based on just keeping your ear open to the industry. The other weird thing about the Globes is they fall a lot harder for Oscar bait than Oscar itself actually does. Like, Clint Eastwood scored 2 out of the 5 Best Director nominations, one for Flags of Our Fathers and one for Letters of Iwo Jima, and both of these movies were, before they were released, thought to be front runners for the Oscar, and then they came out, and people were disappointed in Flags, and that's pretty much fallen by the wayside. But the Globes picked up on it, just like they picked up on Cold Mountain for the same sort of situation back in 2003, and that was locked out of the top categories of the Oscars. The other thing that's come out over the past few weeks are the Critics Awards. There's a whole ton of them. The New York Film Critics Circle, the LA Critics, I don't know what they call their organization, the Chicago Critics, San Diego, Toronto, all these bunch of cities that have Critics Awards that they give out, the critics band together and decide on something. And there's certainly a disconnect lots of times between the critics and the Academy. There's different types of audiences. But if you see these Critics Awards coming together on something, that's worth considering. And in the top 4 categories, the critics are actually remarkably unified this year about 3 of them. Helen Mirren, of course, we already knew that she was a frontrunner before these awards started coming out, but it's like virtually everyone, she's gotten the Best Actress Award, and similarly for Best Actor, and this is more of a surprise, it's a more competitive category this year, Forrest Whitaker has just taken a slew of these things. A little less unanimity, but still a majority vote for Best Director going to Martin Scorsese for The Departed to sort of reaffirm his frontrunner status there. The Picture Awards are more divided, but so far the 2 leaders seem to be The Departed and, interestingly enough, United 93. I saw this movie just recently, and I absolutely believe it deserves whatever honors it's given. It's just an amazing film. Very hard to watch, as I'm sure you can imagine, but in a good way, for lack of a better term. It's a movie that inspires release and catharsis, and not really one that just beats you up for a couple hours. I was reluctant to see this when ahead of time, just because of how heavy and draining I figured this would be, but actually I was really, really, really glad to have seen it and sort of energized me rather than just really draining me.
Yeah, that one has really surprised me. I haven't seen it. I'm still debating whether or not I want to see it right now. But definitely, I have to agree that that one kind of, it came out in the summer, which first of all is not always the greatest time for an awards movie to be released. And it didn't really get a whole lot of buzz going. It wasn't a huge hit.
No, people didn't really see it. Yeah.
And yeah, interesting that the critics, because at the time I didn't really feel like the critics really loved it that well. I mean, it got decent reviews, but it wasn't at all the kind of buzz that some of these other movies have been getting throughout the year.
Yeah, for me, it's gratifying to see. Whether that means it's going to get an Oscar nomination or not, though, I think is still pretty up in the air. It's just not as accessible. I mean, the critics have to see all these movies, and once they've seen it, maybe they're just going to choose it. But the trick is getting people to see it. I mean, like I said, I loved the movie, and I was glad to have seen it, but I was reluctant to see it. The Best Precursor Awards for predicting the Oscars hasn't been announced yet, but they will roll out over the next
2 weeks, and they're the Guild Awards. The awards given out by the Directors Guild, the Screen Actors Guild, the Producers Guild, the Writers Guild. Those are the four big ones, but there's a whole bunch, the cinematographers and editors and so on. Some are better predictors than others. The Directors Guild is particularly good, but they're interesting because of the overlap between membership in the guilds and membership in the academy, and also the fact that these are the same type of people voting on the awards. They're industry workers. So definitely keep your eyes peeled for the guild nominations as they roll out soon. Well, that brings me to the Best Visual Effects Award. I just want to make a final comment about this one, because this is the one technical award that we do ask you to predict in the game, just because I think it's fun and maybe a little bit easier to guess. But there's a trick to this one, and we'll reveal that to you here as a token of our gratitude for listening to our show. See, the way this award works is the eligible films are narrowed down to a short list ahead of time, and the nominees come from that short list. So in the predictions game, to go in there, you can choose from any number of different titles, but we've already got the shortlist down to 7 titles. It's been announced, it's guaranteed that the 3 nominees will come from these 7, and they are Casino Royale, Aragon, Night at the Museum, Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest, Poseidon, Superman Returns, and X-Men The Last Stand. So 3 nominees from those 7 guaranteed. There's some speculation that maybe The Fountain would make it, or Pan's Labyrinth, or V for Vendetta, and so on, but it's just not going to happen. Casino Royale is a really weird one on this list. It was a good movie, but why did the visual effects... I didn't think that would be the standout there.
I don't know. Maybe just because there are a lot of things that seem like stunts, and I don't know. You think it wouldn't really qualify? Maybe there's more CGI than I realized.
Yeah, maybe.
I am surprised. I'll give you all a little favor here. And if you're not picking Pirates of the Caribbean 2 for this category, you're wasting a pick, because I think that's like the surest lock of this Oscar season.
Sure.
But yeah, the visual effects nominations are always kind of a little sketchy. I think a lot of times, I don't know, there's like a certain visual style and look that they like to honor, and things that get a little too out there, like say The Fountain or Pan's Labyrinth, I think tend to get kind of left in the dust.
Yeah, and the cynical take on this award, it's not the best visual effects, it's the most visual effects, and sometimes maybe the most obvious visual effects. I still cringe when I remember that Gladiator won this award with some of the worst but most conspicuous visual effects in recent memory. It was quite terrible.
Wow.
By today's standards.
By the standards of the day when Gladiator was released, I remember laughing in the theater at those terrible CGI effects.
The tigers and the Colosseum, yeah.
It's the Colosseum especially. Ugh.
Not good, yeah. But so hang in there. Those are some clues for maybe refining your guesses on the game. But this is the last time we'll talk about it until the nominations are released. So don't forget to join the game. You got 3 weeks left, and 3 weeks from today, the nominations will be announced, and we'll have the winner of our little contest and the prize posted on our website. And then we'll start the winner's game after that.
We're going to move on in our Film Buffs Dictionary from editing to some camera techniques. We're going to start with the tracking shot. This is one of the oldest film techniques. It was around in the early days of the silent films. D.W. Griffith used it pretty well, for instance, in the 1910s. And the basic idea on a tracking shot is that you have a moving camera. The camera itself is moving. This is specifically different from, say, a zoom. A zoom is actually a movement within a lens, so that the focal point of the image changes. So a tracking shot is specifically different from other sorts of things where the image appears to move. It's different from what's called a pan, which is where the camera tilts but stays stationary, or a zoom, where the lens is moving but the camera itself is staying the same. It's called a tracking shot because in the early days of film, cameras were these huge, bulky things that couldn't be moved around very easily, and so they actually would get a cart that ran on tracks, sort of like the way a train would run, and they would lay steel tracks around the ground and slowly push the camera along these tracks. Some great examples would be if a character is walking, we might have track alongside the character so that we can keep the character straight in our view and move with that character. It's also a little different from some more contemporary techniques, the handheld shot or the Steadicam shot or the crane shot, and the crane shot is where the camera's actually mounted on a crane. It can swoop all around, up and down. We'll maybe talk about this a little later, but the tracking shot itself is roughly stationary on the same level, moving along a track. The tracking shot is sometimes also called the dolly, and that's just because, well, when the camera's on the tracks, it's on a dolly. So that's sometimes you'll hear people say, oh yeah, dolly in, that's the same thing as just tracking in or pushing in. A lot of these terms are kind of interchangeable. These are notoriously difficult to do because they generally tend to be long. If you're going to lay down a bunch of track, you want to have a fairly lengthy shot. You're not going to just do it for a second or two because it's, you know, why bother? So if you're going to go through all that time and expense, you're going to keep the shot for a while, but of course the longer the take, the harder it is to get the shot. You know, if you have a 3-minute tracking shot, and very famously a lot of tracking shots run that long or longer, if someone messes up after 2 minutes and 30 seconds, you gotta go back and do it all over again, and it can be very tiring for actors, and it gets very expensive. You can also use the tracking shot with some other effects. For instance, Hitchcock very, very famously combined the tracking shot, which is moving in, with the zoom in the movie Vertigo. If you zoom out at the same time that you push in, or alternately zoom in as you push out, it does a weird thing because of the way perspective with cameras work. The character appears to stay roughly the same size in the frame, the same focus, but the background gets really distorted, and it makes a really neat effect that gets used a lot these days to show disorientation, that kind of stuff.
That is an interesting effect. It was actually invented by a second unit cameraman that worked for Paramount at the time, and Hitchcock had used that before in Spellbound, but not quite as noticeably. Definitely, I think Vertigo is the best use of that type of shot because it does give you the disorienting feeling of, you know, you're looking down this great height and it seems to elongate before your eyes and you're getting kind of dizzy. But it's also used to convey a sense of menace. And I think an example that a lot of people might be familiar with is in The Fellowship of the Ring, where the hobbits have just tumbled out of the field and they're in the road. And Frodo senses that the ringwraiths are out there, just a little bit beyond vision maybe, but they're hunting him down. And so he looks down the road and it kind of elongates and distorts in front of his eyes. So it suggests this power there, this magical power that's not quite there, but it's coming for him. Also, if a character has just realized something, like the bad guy has got his family tied up at home or something, and he's on the phone hearing this news, the camera will zoom in on his face and the background will kind of fade in the background to simulate that he's not really aware of his surroundings anymore. His attention is just abruptly switched to this other thing. So you can do a lot of neat things with it, but it is often considered a cliche by a lot of people, and so some people look down on its use when it's not really appropriate, as it is in Vertigo.
Right. But the tracking shot itself, not combined with zooms or other little tricks, is, I think, a favorite of a lot of film lovers.
Yeah.
And that's because it's just interesting, because we like long shots, because you don't get them very often to start with, but secondly, because it makes you kind of... Well, one, a lot of directors like to use tracking shots to show off, to see, wow, look how I can move all around and do all these complicated things in this one unbroken take. It's kind of a showy move, but it also feels more realistic. If you have characters who are walking, well, you know, it feels like you're there walking with them. It puts you in the movie, and it just feels neat.
Right, because we don't cut in our real life. We don't see cuts. Real life happens before us in a continuing expanse of time, and so when that happens in the movies, sometimes it feels a bit more authentic. So now that you know a bit about tracking shots, let's talk a bit more about them with specific examples. And that brings us to this week's top six list, which is about the top six traveling shots. It's traveling shots, not tracking shots, because traveling shots include tracking shots, but it also includes other types of camera movements, such as steady cams and handhelds and cranes and all those other types of things.
The point is that the camera itself has to be moving.
Right. This is sort of an interesting top six list because we're not talking about specific movies or people even. We're talking about a unit. But as we said before, the tracking shots or other types of camera movement shots sometimes can be conspicuously interesting, especially if there's a lot of complicated elements involved in creating them. So we're going to talk about our top six. Let me start with my number six, and it comes from Raising Arizona from 1987 by the Coen brothers. And in this movie, there's a point where a camera just races across the desert and then careens up a ladder and speeds across into a window to Nicolas Cage, who is standing there looking pretty alarmed. And this is an exhilarating shot because it appears to be a point of view shot of somebody just zooming across the desert and up this ladder and in a window, and what's he going to do to Nicolas Cage when he gets to him? But the problem is we have no idea whose point of view it is, and then it turns out it's seemingly nobody's point of view. I'm not even really sure what this shot means, but it's definitely an indelible moment, and it's one of those situations where the movie tricks you into remembering it differently. This is kind of interesting because people remember this shot as a single unbroken shot. But in fact, it gets cut in the middle twice, and it cuts away to other actions before cutting back. So the effect is accomplished by three disjoint pieces, one where the camera gets to the bottom of the ladder, and then another shot going up, and the third going into the room. But that movement there is kind of an exhilarating thing, and even though I'm not sure that it makes logical sense, it definitely drives home the emotion that you're supposed to be feeling at that time.
Yeah, that's actually a shot I think that was inspired by Sam Raimi in his Evil Dead movies. He uses a very, very similar technique. He calls it the Evil Dead effect, in which his camera's like flying through. It looks like a point of view, but it's nobody's point of view. And of course, the Coen brothers, who directed Raising Arizona, are good friends with Sam Raimi. They worked together a couple times, and I think it's definitely sort of an homage. My number six pick is an entire movie, Time Code, from 2000 by director Mike Figgis. Time Code is a weird movie. The film consists of four unbroken shots. However, all four of them are on screen at the same time the entire movie. It's four handheld cameras that follow around a series of characters, and we only ever hear the audio for one at a time, but it kind of switches, and literally the screen is divided into four squares, and each one of those squares is a shot, and sometimes the audio is in the top left, sometimes it's in the bottom right, but you're free to put your attention to wherever you'd like. The film itself is sort of a Robert Altman-type thing about a bunch of characters in one day. There's even an earthquake, and very interesting experimental movie. The movie itself isn't that great, but it's mesmerizing to watch how they do this. I guess they actually filmed the entire movie more than a dozen times until they finally got a set of takes that they liked. But yeah, interesting movie and very mesmerizing.
I haven't seen that. That sounds really interesting. My number five is from Panic Room, and it's easily the most gratuitous shot we'll be talking about, I think. I mean, there's a number of pretty good tracking shots in this movie. It's a thriller starring Jodie Foster and Forest Whitaker, but there's this moment where some people are trying to get inside a house, and the camera kind of tracks them as they go from one window to another. The camera's inside the house, and it looks outside of them. But it does all these completely gratuitous stunt kind of things in the process as it travels from one window to another to look out at the bad guys, like traveling through the handle of a coffee pot. Obviously, that was done with the aid of computers to manipulate the shot. But it's just so over the top that you just have to enjoy it for being over the top. Kind of an exhilarating feeling for a movie that's quite suspenseful.
Yeah, I remember seeing that shot in the theater and just being overjoyed. Director David Fincher had played around with that same kind of stuff in Fight Club. He used some computer-generated imagery to like have a tracking shot that traveled through an office building and stuff. But yeah, he really tops himself in Panic Room. It's worth watching, actually, just for those great moments. Well, my number five, I mentioned Robert Altman, and my number six is a Robert Altman movie, The Player, the opening shot, which is several minutes of characters in a Hollywood studio all interacting as we travel seemingly through windows. We overhear hilarious pitch meetings, and we even overhear two characters talking about tracking shots and how wonderful and difficult they are. It's really fun. It's a great way to start a movie that's going to be about a lot of characters interacting in interesting ways and eavesdropping on them.
Yep, and that was my number two. I definitely predicted you would put it on yours. I'm sure you knew I'd put it on mine. It's just a fantastic way to set up a movie that's going to be this clever, self-referential Hollywood satire to have these characters talking about what is actually happening in the movie that we are watching. My number four was butchered by the studio for decades before it was finally restored and can be seen as it was originally intended. It's the famous 3-minute opening of Orson Welles' Touch of Evil from 1958. It's a tracking shot of a busy street in a border town, shot from high above at an angle, and it follows this guy slowly driving a car with a car bomb in it. And he doesn't know there's a bomb in it. And he's going through this seedy Mexican border town with crowds and lights and sounds all around. And then simultaneously, the camera picks up a view of Charlton Heston and Janet Leigh, who are wending their way through the crowds on the sidewalk. So the camera follows them both down. Now, for the 1958 theatrical release, the studio took Orson Welles' movie and said, "No, what is this? We're changing all this stuff because you don't know how to make movies that anybody will want to see." So they superimpose the opening credits over that shot and set it to this blaring, brassy score by Henry Mancini. Welles wrote a 58-page memo to the studio asking them to revert this change along with 50 other changes and cuts that were made to this movie, and he went into detail justifying why he wanted to have each of these changes put back. Well, the studio refused, but the memo survived, and in 1998, the film was re-edited according to the dictates of this memo and re-released. So the credits and the music got taken out of that shot, shot, and wow, what an effect. It's so much more powerful the way it is now, with the soundtrack being all the natural jumble of sounds on the street, people talking and giggling, and car radios playing different sounds, and sounds coming out of the open doorways as they pass by. It all just does an incredible job at conveying a tangible sense of this rich, evocative, very specific place that this story is going to be set in.
Absolutely. Not surprisingly, I've picked Touch of Evil actually for my number two, so I'll get to that in a little bit. It's one of the most famous tracking shots in history. My number four is the movie The Shining from 1980 by Stanley Kubrick. Kubrick really helped pioneer the use of the Steadicam, which is basically a harness that attaches to a cameraman who can then walk around with it. It's a lot more natural and fluid than a tracking shot because you don't have to lay down track. And I think probably the best shot from The Shining seems like a point-of-view shot from the wheel of a tricycle as the young kid wheels through these long, disturbing corridors in this hotel where something strange is happening. And it's an interesting shot. I mean, just it's technically breathtaking. We appear to have the camera down so low it doesn't seem possible that it could be there, and it does a great job of setting up what this creepy and overwhelming hotel feels like from the kid's perspective.
Yeah, it does a great job of enhancing the eeriness of a hotel that is completely empty. But speaking of eerily empty hotels, my number three choice is the creepiest tracking shot I've ever seen from Barton Fink, also by the Coen brothers. And it's shot in Fink's hotel room, and the camera, for initially no good reason, swivels over to the bathroom door and slowly moves into it, and then up close to the sink and goes down the drain. It's only apparent why the shot exists after it's over, and because of that, it's really eerie. There's such a huge sense of foreboding this shot creates, along with the accompanying effects on the soundtrack, of course, because you can't really figure out exactly why this shot is happening, and so it makes it all the creepier as you're furiously trying to figure out what the movie is trying to show you.
Yeah, and I think we actually talked about this. You mentioned it then in episode 6 when we did our movie spotlight on Barton Fink. But again, you picked another Coen Brothers movie. And the Coen Brothers, I think, among modern filmmakers, are some of the best in terms of the way they use their camera. It's a wonderful shot, and it is cool how much more sense it makes in retrospect. Well, my number three shot is from Goodfellas, the infamous Copacabana scene in which we kind of walk with this gangster character as Ray Liotta's narration tells us about how he gets in the back door, comes into the kitchen at the Copacabana and meets all these people and is greasing the palms and gets great seats. And it's exhilarating as we meet all these people and we hear it and we see these sights and sounds and the camera's just moving as we wind our way through it. And we get a real sense that, yeah, we're here living the life, experiencing what this character experiences, which is great because, I mean, first of all, it's showy as all get out, which Scorsese is never going to shy away from. But the other great thing is the movie is all about trying to give us an actual view of what it might have been like to be a gangster. And I think this reinforces that more than anything else in the entire film. It makes it seem exhilarating. We understand maybe why that sort of life of crime is so appealing and how it would be hard to give it up.
Yeah, it doesn't just show us all the things that are different about being in the mob. It shows us some things that are the same, how you can hang out in a restaurant. And things are definitely a little different, but it's a real lifestyle. It's not just a profession. And that brings us to my number two, which, as I've already said, is from Robert Altman's The Player. It's an 8-minute opening tracking shot. And just to give you a little bit more information about how this was done, they did 15 takes, and, you know, the dialogue was actually mostly unscripted. And it's just absolutely hilarious as we look into a meeting where a couple of characters are trying to pitch a movie to a producer, and it's a hilarious exaggeration of the kind of exchange that happens in those sorts of meetings. And then, of course, we already talked about the two characters talking about other tracking shots, but I just find it interesting, and although very consistent with the way Robert Altman works, that a lot of this would be improvised. He just wanted to have this huge tracking shot, and he just kind of let everybody kind of feel their way through what kind of content there would be. It's an interesting way that he works.
Sure, though, I mean, obviously they discussed stuff beforehand,
yeah.
And I probably did some rehearsals and whatnot. They had an idea of who their characters were. We like to talk about improvisation, but it's always planned improvisation with Altman.
Right.
Well, my number two movie, as you mentioned earlier, is the opening shot of Touch of Evil from 1958 by Orson Welles. And I think Sam stole most of my thunder. I really want to mention the audio and how effective it is. I mean, I can't believe the studio butchered it in the original release. one of the great things is as the camera moves, we hear different audio with a bunch of cars lined up with their stereos playing and their tops down, and the music changes as we move because it fades in and out, and it does a great job of really letting us know that we're moving. Not only is the camera moving, but it really sounds like the sound is moving. I don't know what Wells would have done if he had had, say, stereo sound or 5.1 sound. I imagine it would have been really interesting to watch what he did with it. And of course, the camera itself is wonderful, and it's amazing how much is going on in this scene. That's one of the things that makes it so impressive. Most tracking shots are just mainly actors moving around in and out. Here we have people milling all around, we have all these cars moving, a lot is happening, and it all seems very carefully choreographed. I don't know how difficult it must have been to get it, and only somebody like Orson Welles would have had the audacity to think he could pull off something so technically complicated, and it makes it just a virtuoso shot.
Well, speaking of stealing thunder, you actually stole mine from a previous segment. My number one is Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo, the famous scene where Jimmy Stewart, who suffers from a profound fear of heights, has to climb a spiral staircase, and he gets to the top and gets dizzy, and there's that shot that looks straight down the stairwell, tracking in and zooming out at the same time. It looks like the drop to the floor is just expanding in place, becoming longer. It perfectly captures that feeling of vertigo in a visual way. As we mentioned before, it was invented by a second unit cameraman on the Paramount lot. His name was Erman Roberts, and he had developed it before, but it's used by Hitchcock in Spellbound and also Vertigo, and then just by absolutely everybody as the appeal of this kind of shot catches on. It's called a dolly zoom sometimes a contra zoom or a trombone shot, but you see it used a lot for a lot of different reasons, and I mentioned a couple in our previous segment. But I also want to note, just as a footnote, this is simulated kind of amusingly when you think about it in animation in The Lion King, the key dramatic moment early on when the young lion cub discovers what the plot is that's going on, and it zooms in on his face and the background kind of fades into the distance. Obviously, that's not done the same way at all. It's a very deliberate, probably very difficult way to simulate an animation, something that happens kind of naturally when you do a couple of things with a actual camera.
Of course, by naturally, you mean it's extraordinarily complicated to do. A changing focus while moving where the camera is takes a really talented operator and a lot of planning. You can't really...
Well, right, but, you know...
It looks easy, but it's, I think it's pretty difficult.
Right, but you think about the animation that had to be involved in that.
One thing I've actually wondered, just as an aside, is, especially in computer-generated movies, why don't we see more tracking and long shots? There's nothing stopping them from moving the camera wherever they want. I think it's kind of disappointing how traditional so many animated movies feel in the way that they're put together. I think there's a lot of room for more creativity.
But you do see that now and again. The 1999 Tarzan by Disney, there's these great tracking shots of seeing him swinging along through the vines that you'd never see in a live-action movie, up and down tree trunks and vines and things like that. But
sure, but it's the exception.
Yeah, you're right. I think it is the exception, and it would be nice to see more virtuoso sequences.
Well, my number one shot is, once again, like my number six shot, an entire film. It's Russian Ark, the 2002 movie by Alexander Sokurov, and holy Moses, is that an amazing, amazing shot. 96 minutes in length, the entire movie is one unbroken take, and it's a weird kind of movie. It's a trip through the Russian Hermitage Museum, and the museum itself comes to life. We have the point of view of this unseen, unnamed narrator who's walking us through this museum as all of Russian history starts coming to life around us, and the camera does these amazing things. It's on ramps and moving up and down and swirling all around. There's an extended ballroom dance sequence, and I mean, imagine, the camera itself appears to be in a big ballroom dance, moving around and dancing, and we never cut a single time. It actually took them, I guess, 4 tries to get it right. The filmmakers only had one day to shoot the movie because they had to close down the entire museum, and so they had to get it right. And there are a couple of things. I think there's one or two goofs where the camera operator is using a Steadicam, of course, and I think he almost drops it or something, but it ends up working out okay. The movie was filmed on high-definition digital films. I think it was the first feature to be shot on high-def video, but because of the lightweight camera with digital, it was easier, I think, for them to do this kind of thing. But yeah, the movie is just amazing, and I think despite being a recent movie, it really takes the title for most impressive tracking shot of all time.
So let's recap our top six. My number six is from Raising Arizona, the broken tracking shot up the ladder. My number 5 is In Panic Room, where we zoom through a coffee pot handle. My number 4 is the opening to Touch of Evil from 1958, mercifully restored in 1998. My number 3 is the tracking shot down the drain in Barton Fink. Number 2, the opening of The Player, 8 minutes long and very self-referential. My number 1 in Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo, the tracking shot that doesn't look like a tracking shot, but really it is.
And my top 6, starting with number 6, Time Code, the 4 shots as one movie in 2000 by Mike Figgis. Number 5, the opening to The Player from 1992. Number 4, a tricycle point of view shot from The Shining. My number 3, the Copacabana sequence from Goodfellas in 1990. Number 2, the opening of Touch of Evil from 1958. And number 1, the entire 96-minute film Russian Ark from 2002.
In the 1950s, monster movies were king at the drive-ins. Any animal that could be mutated into a giant bloodthirsty city-destroying monster by exposure to radiation was. There was a giant spider, a giant praying mantis, a giant crab, a giant scorpion, a giant Gila monster, a giant mollusk, giant ants, giant shrews, giant leeches, and the list goes on. Well, somebody neglected to tell the producers of Night of the Lepus, today's good-bad movie from 1972, that, one, everybody else had stopped making these movies years ago by 1972, and two, of all the animals to make a monster movie about, surely there are none that could possibly be less frightening than cute little bunny rabbits.
I don't know, tell us Monty Python.
This movie will show a shot of these fuzzy bunnies with adorable snuffly little noses and cuddly soft fur and dear little floppy furry feet, and then we cut to somebody screaming in bloody terror and running for their lives. I mean, there are some menacing-looking shots where the camera is down low and the angle makes the rabbits look evil and there's red paint splattered all over their snuffly little noses. But for the most of the group shots, they just look cute, and it's played totally straight. There isn't a shred of camp here at all. I think some of these big monster movies were a little bit self-aware, and some were very self-aware, but this one's not at all. It's playing it straight, and that's why it makes a good bad movie, the utter failure to pull off an earnest attempt at something.
Yeah, definitely. But I mean, are you telling me that a movie with DeForest Kelly in it is not great? How's that possible?
Yeah. It does have DeForest Kelly from Star Trek.
Come on, Dr. Bones here.
The attractions. Yeah, Bones. I'm a doctor, not a giant rabbit repeller. Before I go further, I want to thank Carrie Patrick for the material I'll be presenting in this segment. A lot of it is hers, a lot of the writing of it, and she was also the person who introduced me to this movie in the first place, so thanks a lot for that, Carrie. Maybe there's a double-edged thank you there. No, it's a good movie.
So she's like writing for you now, what are you telling
She's my, yeah.
I'm bringing in ghostwriters, too.
You don't have a writer?
No, I've been typing this stuff, man.
Oh, jeez.
I'm going to hire one. would you pay her?
Well, you know, that's a contract secret. I can't... So the movie opens with a narration about the balance of nature and overpopulation and some such nonsense. And we see some stock footage of people in Australia rounding up these huge herds of overpopulated rabbits that were doing two very bad things. One, they were destroying crops by eating them up. Two, they were threatening man's very existence. So the narrator tells us, and so the narrator asks us if we have a right to defend ourselves from bunny rabbits, and this leads into our story, which is about a scientist who is hired to come up with a humane way of dealing with the animals. So it's very conscientious about killing these rabbits in a humane way or whatever. Anyway, this scientist has particular experience with humane treatment of animals because when we first see him, he's recording the sound of bats in a cage, and they quiet down after a little while, so to keep them chirping, every so often and he picks up the cage and shakes it all around, and that riles them up nicely. So he knows all about that.
Science at its best.
Right. So he takes home a bucket of bunnies and tries to figure out how to interrupt their breeding cycle, as that would, you know, naturally reduce their numbers. But he's stumped. Nothing's working. There's just one idea left. See, he has this random serum that another scientist sent to him, and he doesn't know what it is. He has no idea what it is or what it'll do, so, you know, why not inject it into the rabbits just to, you know, maybe it'll work.
So explain to me how he comes across this random serum. So
I can't.
So a scientist just, here's some serum. I won't tell you what it does, but have fun.
It was some unrelated thing. He just, you know, they were working together. A serum got sent in the mail or something. And
you know, he was probably what he was. It was a member of the Serum of the Month Club. I signed up for that once, but it's just a huge scam. The bills just start increasing, and you can't cancel. I would say no.
It might have been 7-Up for all we know. But, you know, you got to admit, in the absence of anything else that works, possibly it would cause a genetic mutation in the rabbit that would sterilize it, and then the rabbit could be reintroduced into the rabbit population. And since, as we all know, genetic mutations are contagious, it would spread to the other rabbits and everything would be okay. So it's worth trying, right?
It seems likely, yeah.
Yeah. So he injects the bunny, and unfortunately, while his back is turned, his daughter sneaks the rabbit out of the cage and replaces it with another because the script told her to do that, and she runs away, and the bunny escapes, and obviously this means that hundreds of bunnies mutate into giant, bloodthirsty, city-destroying monsters. Now, before I get into the outrageous giant bunny scenes, I want to talk about the acting. As I said before, it's played totally straight, and it's very funny, but the humor value is a little subtler than some of the other good, bad movies we've talked about. You have to listen for the vocal inflections. For example, there's a great scene where a guy is collecting some rabbits and then putting them in a cage, and he's got his arm way down in there, and he pulls it out suddenly and says, "A rabbit bit me." Well, that would have been okay, but he didn't emphasize the word bit. He emphasized the word rabbit. So it comes out, "A rabbit bit me!" As if, you know, when he's reaching into a cage of rabbits, it might be perfectly ordinary for a coyote to bite him, or maybe a camel. But for a rabbit to bite him, I mean, what a crazy thing.
It's inconceivable.
Inconceivable. So anyway, strange things begin to happen besides bad acting. This huge footprint is discovered that's like 2 feet long, and somebody says, "Must be a mountain lion." It's a pretty big mountain lion. But soon we discover the first couple of victims of the bunnies, which are basically just people with red paint all over them. And once we get a few shots of the giant rabbits, the movie basically never stops showing us giant rabbits, except to cut away to people being scared. And there's never, ever, ever any attempt to splice the footage together. In 1972, they could have used back projections, split screens, forced perspective, any number of fairly inexpensive camera tricks to show the rabbits and the people on the screen at the same time, but it never happens. Well, actually, I guess there are a couple of quick, very quick split screenshots, one of which is just great because you can see the sky in both halves, and it's clearly daytime on one side of the screen and not on the other. But mostly what we get are a few really fast close-up shots of people getting attacked by a guy in a bunny suit, and it's quick so you don't really see much. But the shots of the rabbits alone are the best. Basically, what they did was build miniatures of a bunch of different sets and let the rabbits stampede through it, knocking stuff down and so on. Now and again, they mess it up. There's one shot with some real tomatoes in it, which completely throws off the scale. These would be pumpkin-sized tomatoes if we're to believe the rabbits are really giants. The other weird thing is the sound effects. Whenever we see the stampeding bunnies, it sounds like we're underwater, maybe scuba diving, and as you breathe, the air bubbles float to the surface, and everything sounds hollow, echoey sounds. It's that sound, and it gets played endlessly when the bunnies are on the screen. Anyway, the main characters find one corpse after another, but never quite find the actual rabbits, because, you know, giant bunny rabbits are easy to miss in the desert. But there's one fantastic scene where a scientist discovers traces of saliva at one of the crime scenes, and a cop says, "So, what are you saying? We might be dealing with vampires here?" Maybe.
Yeah, that's saliva. Vampires!
Yeah. Well, that would really stink. I mean, nobody had mentioned vampires before. It's completely out of left field, but it's played totally seriously, as I say. So, there are two big plans to try to conquer the rabbits. One is to trap them in this old mine. They've taken cover in there, so if they blow up all the entrances to the mine, they'll be trapped inside and totally unable to dig their way out, despite some indications that they dug their way in. So, they do that, and later they find that, of all things, they've dug their way out. So, the character, DeForest Kelly, conducts a scientific test to see if there are still any giant rabbits left in the abandoned mine. So, here's the test. He stands over a giant hole in the ground here that they've allegedly crawled out of, and drops a rock in. Thunk. It hits the bottom. He straightens up and says, "They've gone." Because, you know, clearly if the rabbits were still in there somewhere, gravity would be not working properly.
Yeah. They have anti-gravitational fields.
Clever, huh? So the second plan is to electrify the train tracks and herd them over it so they get electrocuted. So they go out with highway flares and the headlights of a ton of different cars. By the way, they get the cars at a drive-in because even though they've evacuated the town, obviously there are still people at the drive-in. And there's this great line. A guy gets on a loudspeaker and says, "Attention, attention, ladies and gentlemen, attention. There's a herd of killer rabbits heading this way." And he says, "Hey, we need your help, so just follow our random instructions about where to line up and shine your headlights." And everybody just calmly accepts the whole thing. And they're told, "Okay, line up your cars right here where thousands of giant killer beasts will be running at you, and just sit there, please. Also, the army will be firing machine guns around through and at you." And they're all, "Okay, that's cool, we'll go do that." When I talked to Carrie about this, she said, "Maybe my faith in humanity is low or something, but there's no freaking way a whole town of people are just going to sit there in their cars with their little kids, their grannies, and so on, and enjoy the new show." I wouldn't, and I consider myself public-spirited. I'd be like, "Okay, you just want the headlights, right? Because I can totally just leave the car running, and I'll be, over here running frantically for miles in the other direction if you need me."
Is it a scientific fact that rabbits are terrified of bright light?
They are in this movie, and it must be true.
I guess so. This is a movie that does take its science seriously.
Yeah. And, you know, a random serum I read somewhere has a 68% chance of making you sensitive to light.
Absolutely,
you just take a random serum, yeah.
It's a common side effect among serums.
Yeah. So anyway, they use these headlights and flares and stuff to channel the rabbits toward the train tracks. And this plan is more successful than the other plan because it's the end of the movie. And so, of course, we get shot after shot after shot, including many repetitions of the same shots of rabbits leaping over train tracks and getting zapped by the electricity. And this gets all of the rabbits, mind you, because naturally the rabbits at the very back of the herd, seeing all the rabbits ahead of them die, will quite happily leap over the corpses of their fallen comrades so that they can die too. It's a little known fact of nature. The other thing is, rabbits cannot jump. It's actually an urban legend that they hop around everywhere, because although the train tracks are not even as wide as one of these rabbits are, not a single one of them manages to jump over the tracks. They only manage to fall onto it and fry. So, anyway, great bad movie all around. Certainly, many of the giant mutated animal movies can also be quite entertaining, but this one stands out for having the absolute cutest, most adorable little snuggly monsters of any of them. Now, do you remember the trivia question we had earlier in the show? It was about the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
I remember that you suckered me into making a terrible guess, making me look foolish.
The question is, who has 5 stars on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, one for each of the 5 industries that they honor on the Walk of Fame?
You know, I have absolutely no idea.
Okay, well, the answer was George Burns. I'm kidding. Did you think you were right?
No.
The answer is Gene Autry, nicknamed the Singing Cowboy. He started out on radio in 1928, signed his first recording contract in 1931, made his first movie in 1934, and produced his own television series starting in 1950. I'm actually not sure where the live theater part came in, but he's got a star for it. The best place to see his movies today is on the Starz Encore Western Channel, which has aired his movies regularly since 2004 when the Starz Entertainment Corporation conducted a restoration of all his movies. I think it's great that enough money is being put into film restoration that we can preserve some of the old B-movies like this and not just all the classics. That's the end of the audio, but catch up on more of what we have to say on our allmovietalk.com website, which is just loaded with great stuff. New things every day. A lot of it is material that we don't even present on the show, so you're only getting half of what we have to offer if you only listen to the episodes every week. But also check out the Rinkworks website, rinkworks.com, and play the Academy Awards predictions game, and check out the movie reviews. And there's some humor columns about movies and stuff like that.
Yeah, and so next week we're going to have another great episode. They're all great, so don't ever imply that they're not, or I'll punch you in the face. But anyway, actually, I'm not sure that's not the best way to get new listeners. So
that's okay.
We're going to give you the carrot instead of the stick. If you listen to all of them, I will give you fabulous prizes there in the mail. Just keep listening and they'll show up, I promise. But next week, we're going to finish up the best of segments talking about the current decade we're in, the 2000s, or the naughty oddies, I like to call them. We're also going to have another industry trend segment, this time all about sound. It's going to be the first part in a series talking about how sound changed the movies. We're going to have a top 6 list for you, of course, and some other good stuff. Cut! Can we please try and get a take that works here?